Hello, this is Ryan Dawson of the Anti-NewCon Report. With me today is repeat guest Dan Sanchez. We did an earlier show on the alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which is currently being played out with the U.S. and ISIS, or Daesh, or ISIL. So I recommend that you go and look up that. Dan is the content manager for FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. He's also a writer for antiwar.com. And he had an interesting article that struck a chord with me called Superheroes Collide in the Post-Traumatic America, which details the current movies. And I want to say that there might be some spoilers in this talk where we have Batman versus Superman and also Captain America Civil War. Dan, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you on again.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to be back.
My inner nerd just clapped with joy when I saw your title. I always read your columns. And when I saw this, I thought, no way, he's one of us. And it was very well done, though. I thought there are a lot of people that stretch comparisons and parallels with literature, and it doesn't always fit. But this one is very fitting, at least for fans who have seen these movies. Which one would you like to start with, Marvel or DC? Put you on the spot.
I guess we could start with DC.
Okay. How is this post-traumatic America, as you say? Tying to 9/11, or which is the event here?
Yeah, 9/11. I try to make the case that the modern superhero movies that are making so much money in the theaters, that they're really striking a chord with Americans because they are post-traumatic movies, that they're really speaking to a public that is still traumatized from 9/11. And you see it in the, you see 9/11 constantly referenced in the imagery of the films, and that is especially the case in the DC films. Batman versus Superman is the most recent one, but then
Metropolis is clearly New York City.
Right, right.
They have fictional cities, but it's been clearly established that Metropolis is New York, where Superman works.
Yep. Yeah. And before that, the first Superman movie in this current lineup of
films, Man of Steel.
Man of Steel. Right. And so in Man of Steel, it really is sort of a different Superman that we're treated to that from the classic Superman. I mean, the classic Superman is usually a sign of hope and a symbol for human potential and aspiration, and he always swoops in to save the day. But in the movie, it only dawned on me the second time I watched it very recently. I didn't realize that the public didn't even see Superman until well after the military is introduced to Superman. So Superman only reveals himself to the U.S. military. And the plot device, the dramatic tension, is all over national security hand-wringing. It's just this national security intrigue storyline, which is completely different from the classical Superman story. Superman is introduced to the public when he swoops in and he saves a bunch of people. And everybody, the look up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman. It's this sort of awe and wonder and aspiration as you look up at this symbol of human potential saving the day.
Also, you get to see that Superman's moral compass is just as strong as his physical abilities. Exactly. And that's what attracts people. That's why I think that superhero has, I mean, DC and Marvel are pretty much the superhero genres, and there are so many thousands of comic books and knockoffs of Superman-like characters, but he's the one that stands out because of that moral compass. That's what people aspire to, not the powers. Supervillains have powers, too. It's what he believes and stands for. And he does say the line, like, oh, the symbol means hope, and they switched in Supergirl to it means better together with family, but he doesn't really provide that because, like you said, he introduces himself to the military. Now, he is knocking down their satellites and doesn't want them tracking him, but the public is sort of split 50-50. But the big thing is, wow, there's life out there, there's aliens. That's what all they come off with.
Right, right, because the first time the public actually sees the cape flutter of Superman is in this awful mass casualty assault on Metropolis by genocidal Kryptonians. So, you know, the first actual encounter is this horrible experience. And I think a lot of writers make too much out of Superman being sort of not caring about civilian casualties. I mean, people make it out to seem that that Superman was actually, you know, directly purposefully causing civilian casualties, and I don't think that the movie really is as guilty of that as a lot of people like to say, but it's more sort of just the symbol about what Superman represents as a character. And it's just striking to me that the classic Superman is a symbol of hope, whereas the modern Superman is a symbol of trauma. And I think that that's why it appeals to people these days.
I think that first criticism of, oh, they had too much collateral damage, well, it wasn't really a choice. Now, in the Christopher Reeve version, he starts to see the city being destroyed and he takes the fight elsewhere, and they follow him and fight him away from the city until they realize he cares about people. But that wasn't going to work because their goal was to destroy the city, and if he wasn't there, they're not going to follow him. They're just going to do what they were doing. So, but what happens is with the advent of the internet, you get a critic and people just start parroting and megaphoning the same theme, and none of them are really thinking about it too deeply. So I didn't pay attention to that. I agree with you. The big divide is a symbol of trauma versus hope. Now, how, in more detail, how is he a symbol of trauma, particularly to 9/11? It is New York. New York was attacked during 9/11. It was one of the cities involved. Metropolis is attacked. You see crumbling skyscrapers, you know, with the heat beams zipping through. And this goes into a scene in Batman versus Superman as well, where I guess our character is Bruce Wayne, where he sees, he's not even Batman yet. He just sees what Superman and General Zod are doing, not knowing who either one of them are, but just this event just happened out of nowhere. Whereas that's not what happened on 9/11, but for people, it's like, oh, they attacked us for our freedom, and there's no reason for this at all, just randomly we're being attacked. The movie, I think, was more, they even tried to trump up some World War II propaganda because General Zod and they were, you know, huge into eugenics and trying to wipe out one race for their own kind of thing. So the epitome of evil, we're purely justified in fighting these. But that's not quite the same as 9/11, because that didn't happen out of the blue, unless you're a George Bush follower.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and so if we could switch to the Marvel movies for a second, that the Avengers has sort of their 9/11 in the first Avengers, and that's an alien attack, another alien attack, but more of an army, and they didn't have as amazing superpowers as the Kryptonians, but they had high-powered weapons. And again, it wasn't as traumatic because in the Superman movies, you really had just the visuals from, especially from down below and buildings collapsing, like, and the pulverized dust of buildings, like filling up the urban canyons of Metropolis. And so that was like especially evocative. With Avengers, it was more of an action, because they focused more on the superheroes knocking out the bad guys and less on the civilian suffering, although, you know, they intimated that there was tremendous civilian suffering. And then that becomes a traumatic event for the superheroes that kind of has repercussions throughout the entire franchise. And it's interesting to me that both Tony Stark in the Marvel movies and Bruce Wayne in the DC movies they're similar in a lot of ways. They're both billionaires. They both get their powers from technology. And they both suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder after the respective attacks on the cities, the analogs of 9/11. And they both have these apocalyptic nightmares, these prophetic apocalyptic nightmares about what's going to happen in the future with these invasions. And and both of them are driven to extremes, to making the problems even worse. So in Avengers 2, Tony Stark has these dreams about all of his comrades being killed in this massive alien attack. And so then that's why he creates the Ultron artificial intelligence in order to forestall that. But that only makes problems even worse. That only leads to more disaster and more casualties. And then it becomes like a spiral that then that created a PTSD bout that he had to deal with in the most recent movie in Civil War. And that is what set him off in letting the government try to regulate try to basically nationalize the Avengers, and sets the conflict with Captain America.
Or internationalize the Avengers. They want the UN control, which is even worse, because you have an uber government that's still controlled by the United States.
Right. And then Bruce Wayne, he has these fever dreams about an alien invasion, and Superman actually being part of the alien invasion and enslaving mankind and massacring people. And that is what drives him to want to actually kill Superman. And that's based on the trauma of when he was, hit the Wayne corporate tower collapsed in Metropolis, and he saw that it was the Kryptonians that did that. And there's this interesting cycle of interventions that, just like with American foreign policy, that we have constant intervention, blowback, intervention in response to the blowback, and then blowback in response to the intervention. That is pretty well mirrored, especially in the Marvel movies. And so,
DC too, where Superman went to save Lois Lane, was in an intervention, I think somewhere in Africa or something, and then Tony Stark in Afghanistan, where he gets the shrapnel in his heart. Well, had he not been a weapons dealer and been over there in the first place, he gets hit by his own weaponry. He sees later, like, Stark written on the missiles and shrapnel and things. So he starts to see blowback from his own company's trading. And then he ends that, and he gets into energy and other things. But he always gets pulled back in because of this PTSD, like you're saying. And then, but in DC as well. And it's also interesting, Batman and Iron Man both had their parents murdered at different ages. But that also drives them. It's sort of like, oh, someone close to me died, so I have to be completely emotional, and I cannot see past this at the greater event, because my mom died and my dad died. So, I'm justified in everything I do.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, and so Iron Man was also, like, deeply traumatic. Like, Iron Man, that was sort of the beginning of all this Marvel franchise. It was the first installment, and the very, very opening scene was just saturated with imagery ripped from the headlines, not so much of 9/11, but of the Iraq War. So the roadside attack on Tony Stark, and being abducted by terrorists, and then waking up with a bag over your head, and then the burlap sack being pulled off, and realizing that he's being surrounded by terrorists talking to a camcorder, just like the beheading of Nick Berg these famous beheadings by terrorists that were that were broadcast over the internet, and these very traumatic images, and they just really referenced that. And
Nick Berg was trailing after Abu Ghraib. It sort of took the headlines away from our mass torture and sacking to, well, look what they did. And of course, they didn't do that. The Iraqis were collectively punished and millions killed. As the line, this is in your article too, but it's the line that Captain America says every time you try and preempt a war, people die every time. Yeah. And this happens. But in Iron Man, they showed both, because they have the terrorist attack, and at the same time when he goes home, he's fighting these kind of corporatist enemies that want to keep the weapons trade and want to keep this sort of military profiteering going. Right. So now he's enemies with his prior business partners. So you see that the terrorists do have a little bit of a point, because these corporatists are in it for the money and not justice or anything. And so you see they're bad on both sides of the ocean. And so yeah, Iron Man's got two different enemies to face. But he always comes back to it because of fear.
That's right. And you see a glimmer of like him returning to kind of mental health when he talks about privatizing world peace in Iron Man 2, when he's standing up and defying the Congress when they want the Iron Man technology. And he said, no, it's my property. You can't have it. But I've privatized world peace for you, so you're welcome. And but then after that, the sort of the PTSD that began in the first Iron Man, it just keeps spiraling, because especially after the Avengers attack, because he feels guilty about that, and that makes him outraged about that, and then that makes him do the intervention in Age of Ultron, and then he has PTSD about that, and so that makes him do the intervention in Civil War.
There's also the Manchurian, who it's a little bit like Osama bin Laden. He keeps issuing these videotapes about global terror, but he ends up just being some actor in Florida. But some of the the bin Laden tapes, there are some conspiracy people that go a little overboard with this, but some of them were faked. I mean, it was audio only, and it's from site. And that doesn't mean all of the whole thing was false or anything, but there were definitely some bad ones that came out, and they were just silly. But
even if none of it was false, it still is a great point that Iron Man 3 makes, because it is sort of like this useful boogeyman that that the Empire and the weapons profiteers are able to use, and in order to sell their wars and to sell their weapons, and and even just assuming that all the conventional stories are true, it's still the case that it's just like this thing that's blown way out of proportion, that they do so much fear-mongering about it, about this threat that is still less of a threat than like being struck by lightning to any individual person, but they're able to use it to sow terror among the public and send them into like a stampede of a warpath, and to the benefit of the power, of the state, because everybody rallies around the state because they're so panicked about this overblown threat.
Yeah, the whole thing got started in a way like this, with the destroyer being sent down to get rid of Thor in some small town, and as a reaction to that attack on the small town, which Thor quickly, destroyed with minimal damage. S.H.I.E.L.D. gets the Tesseract, or the Cosmic Cube, and then there's an alien response to that because they're weaponizing this, and that leads to Avengers. The whole thing started because of the small attack on the town, a one-on-one fight between super beings. And so S.H.I.E.L.D. too, in a way, you see in Captain America 2, that he realizes already they're using this fear to weaponize people. And this is how the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are created, was from Loki's staff secretly. That one encased by terrorist group. But they're doing the same thing the U.S. government, SHIELD is doing. They're doing the same thing. They're weaponizing this alien technology for their own purposes. And so it's one series of blowback after another.
Yeah. Although, yeah, and it's the government failing upward, because every time there's this horrible results from government intervention, but then a lot of times the public and even main characters like Tony Stark end up deferring even more to the government because of the failures of the government. And so it's this perverse cycle. And you would think that, you know, Tony Stark, of all people, especially with his original defiance of the Congress, that he would remember that. I mean, he would remember that what was so traumatic about, one of the most traumatic things about the alien attack in New York, was him having to redirect a nuclear missile that was on its way to New York, that the government...
Exactly. Someone needs to keep Avengers in check. You're the guys that were going to nuke New York City, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting that the small town attack, that was sort of the seed of all this cycle of interventions, because it kind of reminds me of the Yazidis on the mountain, mm-hmm. when ISIS was on the rampage, there wasn't that much of a push for intervention among the U.S., except that there was this one sob story that the media was pushing about this religious minority, the Yazidis, who were trapped on this mountain by ISIS, and so American public opinion was just like, oh, well, you know, we're kind of over this whole war on terror thing. We're kind of shell shocked from the Iraq War, but this one humanitarian intervention, it seemed like, you know, just the decent thing to do.
Well, that's the liberal demographic branding for war, yeah. Is it's okay if you can find some way, authentic or not, where you're saving someone else, and it's not authentic. It never is. We saw that as one of the rationalizations for the Iraq War. After the invasion, after the lies about WMDs, they said, well, we went in to liberate the Kurds, or we went into Afghanistan to build schools for women, and we had the story of the woman that had her nose chopped off or whatever, some particular case to justify the total, you know, regime change and slaughter of entire cities, is focused on something like this. And they get a pass, or Gaddafi is another one. It was humanitarian. We were preempting him shooting people by shooting people.
And the whole Yazidi episode, just like the small town episode in Thor, was the seeds for everything else, because the U.S. did intervene and attack ISIS in order to provide the Yazidis cover, and it turned out to be just overblown anyway, that there weren't nearly as many Yazidis on the mountain as the media said, and a lot of the Yazidis didn't want to leave, but it didn't matter, because by that time it was off to the races, because ISIS then retaliated again, kind of a small scale retaliation. It was in the scheme of things, beheading some Westerners, like two or three Westerners, and yes, it was traumatic. It was this horrible thing, but it wasn't like this, you know, threat to the country.
Also, nothing helped ISIS recruit more than Big Satan thumbing their nose at them. You know, with America attacking, there are a lot of people in Iraq that especially that have grown up with two American invasions and sanctions that killed over 500,000 children. And so if America is against ISIS, ISIS must be good in their eyes. I mean, if you're a young kid and you're, you know, 18, 19 years old, and you see them as the ones standing up against the United States, then it seems like, well, whatever side is against the United States is for us. Right. Some people saw it that way. I think it helped them recruit. And also in the to bring it back to Avengers, in Civil War, you have this terrorist attack in Nigeria. So there's a bombing in Africa, which sets this off. And that's sort of like Osama bin Laden's embassy bombings in the 90s.
That's right.
And the reaction that Clinton did, which just escalated and made everything worse. We never look at our intervention in Afghanistan the first time, financing the Mujahideen through BCCI, which was created by Prince bin Fasil in the Safari Club, which was created by the CIA, by George Bush's father. I mean, his sister is Bandar Bush's wife, and these people are involved with directly financing 9/11 hijackers. The guys on our team that we used in Afghanistan the first time, and the bank that they laundered money through, well, they didn't use BCCI 9/11, but they used Riggs, which was one of the other banks, were all used again in an attack on ourselves, on our own territory. And so we're chasing monsters we create, over just like Ultron. I mean, he was a literally a monster of our own making. I hope people can see that in the films, more than just the fighting and, oh, it's cool. I hope they all look deeper into it than that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting to wonder whether, you know, what kind of messages. It seems like the Russo brothers do have sort of libertarian inclinations, at least, or at least sort of like anti-national security state and anti-imperial inclinations. But
people were mad that they made Captain America a libertarian, but I say he's always been a libertarian. He dresses in the red, white, and blue, and for a long time I wouldn't read those comics because I thought, oh, this is just some patriotic shove-it-down-your-throat nonsense. And when friends of mine pushed me, they're like, no, it's the opposite. They all uphold him at that since World War II, but he pulls a complete reversal and says we've lost everything and he's totally anti-government. And ultimately gets killed for that, not in the movie.
It's great because, even though he's draped in the flag, you know, there are multiple possible meanings of America, and America can also be sort of a tradition, of liberty, and not America, the nation state, but just America as just a community of people who live sort of in the same landmass and who opposed their government in a lot of ways, a lot more than other people did. And so sort of an opposition to the American government is sort of a tradition. And so you can think of that as sort of Americanism, and think of Captain America as sort of representing the.
He's sort of that Jeffersonian version, because you have ever since the times of Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, we've had this conflict where, I mean, there's a sort of famous quote, and I think Voltaire said it before either one of them, but that, you know, those who will trade an ounce of liberty for security will have neither and deserve neither.
Yeah.
A lot of people changed the way that said, but that's what they said. And that seems to be the case again. We're always, there's some sort of attack. Recently we've had this shooting in Orlando, for example. And you have all the partisans have their monster they want to slay. Some liberals want to get rid of guns. Conservatives see it as, well, he's the son of immigrants, so it's an immigration problem. And everybody has their target to blame. Before it happened, you could predict what they were going to blame it on. And not really looking at the individual and the particular history of somebody whose father was an asset of the CIA. He met with the FBI on at least two occasions, and their FBI has been caught over and over in entrapment programs. It doesn't mean this is what happened, but it's something worth looking at. But it's hard to get down to that because everybody's like, it's the guns. It's an attack on gays. No, it's the immigration. No, it's this. No, it's that. What's your two cents on this shooting? Do you think we're going to overreact again or not learn from this event?
It's hard to predict, but I do think that if we do overreact, that it will just perpetuate this cycle that the attack itself was part of. And so in a recent article, I characterized it as a cycle of terror and hate, because it's an interesting tension that a lot of people are, you know, the left is trying to characterize it as a hate crime, and focusing on the fact that it was against gays and it was with guns. And then the right is trying to just characterize it as terrorism and as an example of Islam being a dangerous religion and as a case for like restricting immigration and that kind of thing. And so, but in a way, it was terrorism and a hate crime. What were you going
to
say?
I said, I was getting ready to say they seem to both be wrong, because it was an attack on his peers, because this guy was a homosexual himself and went to the bar that he attacked frequently, called it homosexual, but still, it was an attack on people he's familiar with in a place that's why he probably did that. He's not really religious, because he claimed to be part of ISIS and then later claimed to be part of Hezbollah, even though those two are fighting with each other. Now, I can't imagine, unless you're severely mentally ill or extremely low IQ, that anybody could be part of either one of these groups and not know the difference between the two and not know that they're fighting each other. It's just, oh yeah, I'm part of, oh, I want to be scary, so I'll just say I'm part of ISIS. Oh, that doesn't work. Well, it's Hezbollah then. Well, one's Sunni, one's Shiite, and they're fighting with each other. So he doesn't even know the basics about Islam. So I don't think he's really motivated by Islam, because he doesn't even know the difference between these two factions at all. And most Muslims in the United States would know that. Most non-Muslims in the United States would know that. If you've been following Iraq and Syria at all, you would know that. You don't have to be Muslim to know the difference between Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda. But this guy didn't know. And so he's attacking his peers, and he really isn't motivated by religion. He's motivated by, here's something America hates and I hate America, so I'm going to say I'm part of that, but he really doesn't have a part of it. This is a guy acting by himself.
What do you think about the report from one of the witnesses said that he wanted to convince Americans to stop bombing his country?
Maybe it's just something you can, I mean, what country haven't we bombed? But it could be true. I mean, he's in this documentary by the BBC as one of the workers on the oil rigs during the oil spill, the BP oil spill. And he's saying, oh, it's all about money. These people don't even care, you know, how well the cleanup's going. They actually hope it lasts longer so they get more paychecks. So you can see this guy's disgruntled a long time ago. But I don't know, like, why a witness is saying this. Wayne, why doesn't he say that himself right now? You know, that just seems to me like a story that someone came up with. Because, yes, it is wrong that we're bombing other people's countries, but that just seems like something a witness would say, because that's the witness's agenda, not the guy's agenda. Because if that's really true, then the guy would be saying that now.
But isn't he dead?
Oh, I thought he wasn't.
No, yeah, he's...
I thought they shot him in him.
No, he's... I'm pretty sure he's dead, yeah.
That's how little I care about it. Another shooting? I just read his background, so well, if he's gone, then, yeah, well, maybe then. Maybe so.
Yeah.
It just seems like weird that when did he have time to stop and have these conversations with these people?
Yeah, I mean... A lot of these sort of narratives that the media push, they are suspect. And but I think that even without knowing exactly what happened, you can still consider it part of a cycle of terror and hate, because for one thing, that you know its effect. We don't know exactly its motivation, but we know its effect, that we know that it has terrorized a lot of Americans. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about in terms of the superhero movies being so much about trauma. And and there's this great part in the Batman versus Superman where Alfred is telling Bruce Wayne that he's seen good men turn bad, because he's seen like the hate well up inside, and it turns and that's what happened to Bruce Wayne, that like he was so traumatized by what happened in Metropolis that it just completely broke his moral compass. And that's exactly what happens with terrorism, is that people get so traumatized that that they just lash out, and they indulge in basically reciprocating in kind against a whole population that they think is somehow associated with the individual who did the attack. And so, and that can come about in a number of ways, that like after 9/11, the fact that Iraq was a Muslim country, even though it had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, and but because it was Muslim, I mean, that was close enough for the people who were so terrorized and so ignorant that they just wanted to lash out at something that looked like what hurt them.
That's why they accepted the lies so easily, because Iraq was lied about. They said that 9/11 hijackers got anthrax from Iraqi officials in Prague. So with that, which was not true, but that was an official lie stated on newspapers and on TV, that Iraq did have something to do with 9/11, because they gave anthrax to hijackers, and there was an anthrax attack following 9/11 that had 9/11 written on the notes, death to America and death to Israel, automatically making Israel's enemies, America's enemies. It turned out it wasn't from Iraq or Al-Qaeda. Still had these written on it. They blamed it eventually on one guy named Bruce Ivins, who somehow was in New Jersey and Florida at the same time sending these things. And that was case closed, and that guy killed himself before trial, and that was the end of it. But officially, Iraq was part of 9/11. But anybody with two brain cells to rub together could have looked at that and said, wait a minute, we don't have evidence for this claim yet. And they lied about X, Y, and Z already, so why am I going to believe that one? There were a couple more lies that tied it to 9/11, but the public wanted shock and awe so bad. They wanted to, you know, look, we got our two front teeth knocked out in New York. We need to beat the hell out of somebody. So when the lies came, they didn't have any skepticism. They just said, yes, because I want to beat the shit out of somebody. They said it's rock good. Let's take them out. They're brown. They're Muslim. He's got a mustache. Let's go.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And you see that now. I mean, it's less an impetus towards foreign intervention and more towards domestic repression and a big push to surveil and restrict and block entry of Muslims across the board. But it's the same kind of collectivist mindset. And so when I talk about the cycle of terror and hate, I characterize terror as an excess of fear. Like fear can be a rational response to a threat, and then terror can be defined as an excess of that. And then terror can easily transmute into hate, which can be thought of as an excess of anger, because anger can also be a rational response to an offender. And hate can be seen as excessive in the sense that it's anger dispersed through a collectivist lens. And so it scatters over everyone who is considered to be part of the same category as the offender. And so that's what you see with all this Islamophobia in response to recent attacks. And then it's the same kind of collectivist prism that the left is looking through when they call for gun restrictions because of this attack. I mean, a big push from the left now is that they want to make it illegal for anyone on the terror watch list to purchase a gun.
They want to get the no-fly list from keeping guns too, even though there are a lot of mistakes on that.
Right, and so it's just a complete removal of your Second Amendment rights without due process.
But isn't it odd that they can see the collectivism on the other side but not their own? Like, people on the right could say there are millions of responsible gun owners and you're punishing everyone because of what some mentally ill person that met with the FBI did, but it's Islam. And then the left can correctly say it's not Islam didn't attack, an individual guy did. But guns, you know, they see the collectivism on the other side, but they don't see the collectivism for themselves, which is odd to me, because I don't understand how you're able to see it in one case and not your own. And it's sort of like a religious cult itself. Like, you can see the silliness of miracles and stuff in other faiths, but yours are all real.
You know? Yeah. I mean, it's really based on what I have this other article called "These Two Scholars Discovered the Primal Source of War," and one of the scholars I talk about is Ludwig von Mises, and Mises traces all statism, both left statism and right statism, to what he calls the Montaigne dogma. And it's the dogma that your group cannot benefit except at the expense of another group. And so it breeds this kind of tribalism and this this factionalism. And so he characterizes, he contrasts the left and the right in terms of Marxist class warriors and nationalist military warriors, and they both believe in sort of this eternal law of irreconcilable conflict, that the Marxists think that the only way their class can benefit is at the expense of another class, so that labor can only benefit at the expense of capital, and the nationalists believe that their nation can only benefit if it at the expense of another nation through conquest and through the extraction of booty or of Lebensraum. And really you see that in play now because it's that sort of warfare mentality that where the right sees Islam as just this rival herd, and so that we
How did our oil get under their sand?
Yeah, we in the West can only thrive economically if we steal their oil. We can only feel secure if we subjugate them and put them under our thumb. And
the right seems to have this idea of like the Pavlovian dog. Like, people are just like a dog that, if you just beat it enough, it'll listen to you. And that just doesn't work. And people aren't Pavlovian dogs. And the left has this collectivism. And the left, in a way, is less prejudiced in some fields and more prejudiced than others, because they'll do something like, okay, well, we won't collectively blame Islam or some minority group. They're good on that. But then they'll uphold this sort of collectivist guilt for, say, Caucasian people. They're like, well, white people came and killed the Indians, and white people had slaves, and white people did this, and white, and they're blaming the actions of particular governments on an entire race of people who look like each other, as if it's just some genetic disposition that certain white countries behave certain ways. And they can't get around that. I say, well, I didn't do anything. My neighbor Bob didn't have any slaves or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, they have this collectivist, the same collectivism that racists have, where they'll point to certain individuals who maybe invented something or did something great, and they're like, well, I look like that person, so now my whole group is better than you or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's the same stupidity. It's just one wants to grab every accomplishment by anybody in their group, and the other wants to blame the entire group for any bad thing that governments did, and yeah. And not looking at the good things, because it was Western society that ended slavery too. It was Western society that gave us women's suffrage. It was Western society that did all these beautiful things, but they don't see that. They focused on problems that the whole world had, because everyone else had slaves too. Everyone else that treated women like that. And so it's odd to me, like they need some kind of, like, victimhood is a badge almost.
Mm-hmm.
And in the right psychology, it wants to be the sort of daddy master, like the, well, we'll just go and smash him and that'll learn. Yeah, we'll make a glass parking lot. That'll teach him. how do we get around this?
Yeah, it's hard, because it's hard to break through that collectivist prison that they're looking through. I mean, really, it's, I've just been more interested these days in teaching people about the freedom philosophy as it applies to their own life. Mm-hmm. I have this feeling that that people have less skin in the game in terms of expressing an opinion about, you know, broad social things. So it costs nothing to virtue signal, basically.
Right,
so if you're in a social milieu where you sort of get kudos for, you know, being a good, decent Democrat or a good, decent Republican, then it's so easy to just virtue signal, and there really isn't that much benefit for you in pursuing the actual truth, because whatever is true or not, it's not like your decision about politics is going to, you know, change the body politic altogether. And so it's easy for people to just sort of, you know, go based on what they've been schooled and what they've been inculcated in, and just continue virtue signaling in that regard. But what's interesting,
it allows them to hide crime too, I think, because it's like, well, World War II is justified because we saved the Jews. Therefore, mm-hmm. firebombing Hamburg and Dresden and Tokyo and stuff, that's all whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It
insulates them from guilt.
Right.
Well, I mean, obviously they shouldn't feel guilt because they weren't the ones who did it, but
their support for their actions, though. Like, well, I would have supported that or something.
Yeah, and they identify with America, so with the nation state and with this sort of like symbol, this like mystical union of America. They identify it, so they take it personally.
I think the comedian Doug Stanhope, maybe he's talking about some Americans in a bar drinking, and they're getting mad at some French guy, and like, well, if it weren't for us, you'd be speaking German. And they're all self-righteous, and he's like, really, Tom? We did that? We saved the French? Because I don't remember being in any trenches. You and I did that? Like, I think we watched SportsCenter yesterday.
That's a great bit, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And then he says, like, nationalism makes you pissed off at people who didn't do anything to you and takes credit for things that makes you take credit for things you had no part of, part in.
Yeah, basically. Like we did that.
Yeah. So I just wonder if, because I think the freedom philosophy can really apply to the individual's life and sort of realizing that this sort of statism that you've been inculcated to hold since school, that it's holding you yourself back because it's this philosophy of obedience and philosophy of like of non-initiative. And so people going through their lives, they're on this like conveyor belt going through school, and they're just basically following orders and following these paths that have
another
been
brick in the wall. As Roger Waters said in Pink Floyd, I got to meet him recently, and hopefully I'll be screening a film here. I'm plugging something, but we're screening a film about Palestine in Los Angeles this August, and he was the narrator for that. And I realized, wow, that was, as a child, I heard this song, another brick in the wall. I'm like, this is the same guy. it just kind of, I mean, I knew that, but I didn't really know that, like, I've been following this person way longer than I realized. And now I'm grown up and he's doing stuff with me. It's neat. but it's true that this sort of schooling, I call it indoctrination more than education, at least politically. Like, of course you learn things in school. As George Carlin says, they want you at least smart enough to read the road signs and stuff, so you can be obedient. But there's this sort of, you get virtue through obedience. Do your homework and all your busy work, and you get rewarded with these plus marks and stickers and whatever. Yeah. And the focus is more on obedience than the actual application of whatever it is you're learning, which most of which is not applicable to anything. It's just academic minutia for the sake of it to see whether you'll do it or not, because that's a way of testing your obedience. And then stater's going to state.
That's right. And it's indoctrination is a big part of it, but also just conditioning. It's more about the less about the content and more about just the process, the activities that they, just the habits that they're, that they're being instilled, that is being instilled in them. And that is the big thing that's holding people back, even more than any kind of ideological errors that they have. And because basically it's this mindset of, it just crushes any kind of entrepreneurial spirit in them. And so all their life, they're looking for different conveyor belts to transfer over to. And I think that's what is keeping them from finding rewarding work and finding the joy and value creation for in participating in the market society and really accomplishing great things, because that's not what you're all about. You're all about, just doing what's been assigned to you and following certain expectations. And that's just a very inert way to live. And that's why I think that's why a lot of, especially millennials, are so bored with life. Like, they don't know how to be adults because any kind of initiative and
risk and failure. I think that's why so many of them don't know what to do. And I swear, there are a lot of professional students, not because they're in love with knowledge, and it's because they're scared of the real world. They don't want to start their life. Like that. I mean, the fact that we refer to school is like, well, there's school and then real life, or school in the real world. Well, what is this? Isn't this part of the real world? It's so different from, what's outside of school, that we use language like, well, that out in the real world, and then school's this insulated fantasy land, because everything's taken care of, and you have a direction chosen for you, and you really can't fail. Like, you just, and it's this really the statist model, because you're not allowed to fail. The failure is what allows success in markets and business and everything else, and they are afraid to leave the tit, so to speak, to go be innovative and make something of themselves and actualize their potentials, as Krishnamurti or Bruce Lee would have said. That is gone, and that, I think that causes a sort of a mild depression and boredom. Because if you're not self-actualizing, what's the other alternative? You're seeking external validation, and that leads to the collectivism and the group mentality and virtue signaling.
And so I think that's sort of the answer to getting to people, because with this question about your own life philosophy and your own flourishing, you do have skin in the game. Like, it really matters whether you accept the right answer or the wrong answer. And so then people have more motivation to really frankly and honestly assess whether their life philosophy is even, if you really, you know, challenge them with these ideas and with how they might be able to make their lives better. And so, and then once they realize that, and once they realize that, okay, I need to take myself out of that mindset, I need to take myself out of the situations that are fostering dependency in me and crushing my initiative. And once people have a respect for their own initiative and their own enterprise, then I think it's only natural that they would see how, just like they were being held back by sort of this very command and control lifestyle, they can see how the whole world is being held back by a command and control system.
It's why millennials flock to Bernie Sanders. Oh, I'm going to give you free things, and I'm going to get all that. I'm going to use tax money to prop up overpriced industries without questioning why they're overpriced in the first place. They see that as, oh, another dad, someone to take care of me forever. And it's ironic because all in the indoctrinated public school system, I think all of them read Catcher in the Rye, and the point of that book is, you know, let them go. Like, you have to allow the potential of failure to succeed. Otherwise, you're fostering dependency, and you've already failed. Because and that, as someone commented on a YouTube video I made, like, a lot of over-socialized liberals are basically still in need of parenting. Like, they never really matured on that level. They get their news from Comedy Central and Facebook memes, and basically pooing on very safe issues like, well, I hate racists. Well, duh. Like, who doesn't, you know? Like, they want to get, because they're in such need of external validation that they have to constantly attack super safe targets, like saying, well, I'm not sexist or something. Like, well, that's very socially acceptable, and like 99.9% of people will agree with you, and so it's a way that you can get group validation. And that's what's the problem in my mind, in my opinion, is a problem. Is if you're always seeking group validation, and then you're going to get stuck to super safe issues and never really challenge the status quo at things that have consequences, you know, like opposing this war in Syria and you know, freedom for Palestinians and things like this, that actually will get you, can hurt your social status. Because there's at least half the people that will nail you for that. So
that's a great analysis. I mean, really, it's kind of like that's why that virtue signaling that I was talking about earlier, that it's so addictive to people, that it's sort of like they're addicts of the dopamine, the little dopamine rush that they would get every time they were patted on the head.
Yeah, please pat me on the back. Exactly.
Yeah, and so they're just constantly looking for that.
And I think there's a bit of it too, and we can go a little deeper into the psychology, but they have this collectivist skill, especially among white liberals, I feel like, that some of them actually do or used to harbor prejudice towards, say, minorities or homosexuals or pick your ism, and they don't now, sincerely, but maybe secretly they used to, and it wasn't socially acceptable, but they need to be socially accepted at the same time. And that one is greater than their own prejudice. So part of their signaling is this sort of what I call paternalistic racism. Like the reason they support affirmative action or giving special rights to whoever is because they really do feel like they're inferior and need extra help. And they're the, you know, above class. We got to help these little Africans. We got to help these people because they're totally incapable of doing it on their own because of our collectivist group shit on their collectivist group. And it seems to me like part of their signaling is also a process of getting over their own silly prejudices for like a group within that group. I see mm-hmm. that, especially on college campuses. It's really super active with the same kind of groups that give collectivist racial guilt and stuff. It's there. Nader did a talk. I forgot the school. It was somewhere in the East Coast, but he did this really great talk about the origins of the Iraq War and the problem with the two-tier party system and all that. And when it came to Q&A, all they wanted to talk to him, ask him about was race and stuff. Like, the Nader was alive during segregation. And I mean, he fought for real civil rights, you know. And these kids, they're signaling. And Nader just is like, all right, you know what? If you want to get a rise out of young kids today, you don't tell them about Obama's drone strikes and the killing and the sanctions murdering hundreds of thousands of people starving to death. And that just nothing. But you say a racial slur or something like Ron Paul's newsletters, which he wasn't even guilty of. Like, that is what gets a rise out of the youth today, is anything that hits these sort of what I call safety target areas, which is odd because seems like killing millions of people ought to be a safety target area, but it isn't because it doesn't help them through this process of getting over their own closet prejudices. Everybody knows killing is wrong. So that's why I say that is part of this, is them working out their own prejudices and getting into the socially acceptable group that's, you know, from TV and everything else that they want to be part of. I see that. And even hating on some of their own traditional values because it's not from the right, the proper channels of, you know, champion minorities or whatever. Mm-hmm. It is sad. It really, the collectivism is the disease. Mm-hmm. It's not a disease, but, you know, metaphorically.
Yeah.
Or maybe it is. is hyper-liberalism a mental illness? I don't know. That would be Ann Coulter. Right. Yeah. The same woman that said a little bit of radiation is good for you.
I think Michael Savage had a book called like Liberalism is a Mental Disorder or something like that. So
Michael Savage is a mental disorder.
Yeah.
You're a jungle theme. They're so good on the criticism of each other though.
Right.
But completely absent of their own. And that's right. Why we get these outside circles, the freedom philosophy, anarchists too, like libertarians especially, though, they have a working model. And yet, again and again, in presidential elections, we end up with two warmongers. Mm-hmm. And even in the primaries, like we had, there were three anti-war candidates for the Democrats. You had O'Malley and Jim Webb and Lincoln Chafee, all against the wars and so on. And then you had two warmongers, Bernie Sanders and Hillary. And the two of them won every primary. And on the Republican side, I guess Rand Paul was anti-war except for Afghanistan. The rest of them sucked. But Trump won them. Trump and Cruz. I think Rubio got one, I think, you know, Oklahoma or something, whatever. The three warmongers got everything. Mm-hmm. And however, Trump was less warmongering than Cruz and Rubio. But that's not hard to do because they're totally terrible on everything. And now our choices are Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump,
Which
is why I moved. But, I mean, if I was forced in the corner, I'll take Trump over Hillary because I think Hillary is the worst. Like, just – there will be resistance towards Trump more so than Hillary. Mm-hmm. And she's just – I don't know. It's such a terrible situation. I pity all of you. Which is why your philosophy about philosophy is correct. We have to focus on changing your life as an individual because appealing to the lowest common denominator is a lost cause. Mm-hmm. because we're not on the lowest common denominator, so it isn't going to work. This actually requires thinking. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. It requires thinking.
And it really, I mean, politics is another one of those, like electoral politics is one of the, another one of those things where there's very little cost to being wrong. And that was one of the points that I think Brian Kaplan made in his Myth of the Rational Voter, that where he called it, like, I think, rational ignorance, where, you know, it really is rational to be ignorant about these political issues because, you know, your impact, like whether you come up on, come out on the right side, doesn't really have much bearing on your own life. And so again, that leads to just the ease of virtue signaling. And it's just, it's really easy to just like, oh, you know, I'm a decent person and I signal that by, you know, lambasting Trump or by lambasting Clinton. And then it becomes just like this big distraction, because then it's just this contest of personalities and just people just virtue signaling at each other, and no truth is going to like rise to the top out of that process. So that's why I think it really makes sense to just focus on the individual, just focus on people sort of like spiritually emancipating themselves and improving their lives, because that is where they do have skin in the game, that they have every motivation to want to embrace sort of the life philosophy that will actually improve their individual lives. And that can be the first step towards being a decent person in terms of your social ideology.
You really nailed it today. It's virtue signaling without any consequence. It label Trump as Hitler and then bash on the new Hitler and then what a good boy am I. Even though Hillary and several other candidates have all voted for security fence and wall and things, that the things they hate about Trump the most have been supported by the team they're on at the same time. And it's weird to me because I think a lot of Bernie supporters especially are good people in the sense that they are against corporatism, they're against war, wars of choice, and yet they don't realize that Bernie is pro-war and he has been pro-corporatism in his actions, not in his rhetoric. But that's not important to them. What's important to them is having a symbol through which to virtue signal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to take it down to the individual level. And I think that's why these superhero films are so appealing, other than just they're cool, is that you rarely get much nuance in these. Like, Star Wars is clearly bad versus good. Yeah, there is no. But in this, you see some political arguments with, you know, when the Avengers are meeting and Captain America and Iron Man are discussing this and hashing this out, or Alfred talking to Batman and saying, this is how good men turn bad. You do have those moments in these Marvel and DC films, and even better in the books. And yes, I read the books. And yes, I'm in my 30s and I read comic books. But it's better. And I think it's sort of a unique to the United States and maybe somewhat Japan, that we have the like genre of superhero and comic books like that, because it doesn't really exist anywhere else in the world. They just read ours or anime sometimes. But there might be a counterexample, but I think that's really it. That's two countries that behave this way, that have this sort of there's other comics. There's like horror, like vampires and with the traditional stuff and detective things, but you don't really see superheroes except America and a little bit Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in a way, sort of adding to like what we're talking about, virtue signaling by denouncing the enemy, there's also sort of a part of politics that is holding back people back as individuals in their lives. On the other side, not denouncing the enemy candidate, but treating the candidate that you favor as this champion for you and investing all of your hope for, like, you know, future success, or an inordinate amount of your hope for future success in this figure. And when
Obama will have transparency and close Gitmo.
Right.
And Gitmo's larger than it's ever been, and we throw whistleblowers in jail.
Right. And on in a sort of broad, bigger perspective, just the basic hopes that we'll have economic prosperity, and so we as individuals will have, like, good jobs and get raises and that kind of thing, and security, that we'll be safe in our homes and that kind of thing. And this over-investment of, you know, trying to look toward a political figure for providing that is just really irrational, because, you know, who you vote for is not going to sway any election. So all this sort of, like, mental energy that people put into these political debates, I mean, even if you convince, like, you know, half your friends to follow you and support this one candidate, that's not going to swing the election. Whereas
most states are already locked in. Like, right. Unless you're in a swing state, your state is going for the red or blue already, right. No matter what you do. I see voting on referendums and things, but and as far as the presidency goes, yeah, you're fusing up a lot of energy over nothing, because most of the time it's already a foregone conclusion what your state's, who your state's going to vote for, even if you spoke to all your friends, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
It's going to be what it is.
I ran this article by T.K. Coleman recently on fee.org called "Who I'm Voting For This Year." And he makes the case that if only people were more invested, less invested in trying to get people to show up for, you know, tossing a ballot in one direction or another, if they were as invested and passionate about showing up to cast a vote of confidence in their own potential. If only they put that much energy into their own lives, because your own life is where you have the potential to act, where, you know, whether you're actually going to be economically secure or physically secure or prospering, I mean, that's where you actually have a lot of influence. And so just sort of breaking people out of that political spell, I think would do a lot of good, just making them realize that all of this is just a big circus sideshow. Like, it's not relevant to your life. Like, whether you...
Which is quoting Tool. I don't know if you did that on purpose or not, but the circus sideshow is from the Tool song.
Awesome. Oh, okay. No, I didn't know that song.
I'll send it to you. I think our great weapon, like, I like doing podcasts like this, talking about psychology, talking about philosophy, and that's needed for our fellow nerds. But I think the greater weapon is, like, what Avengers is doing. Like, it's music and films, and films especially, is the way to reach people, because we're fighting against the school system, basically. This sort of indoctrination. George Carlin put it beautifully again about, you know, oh, well, Every 4 years they let you come in and vote.
Yeah.
That kind of comedy, not just comedy broadly, but that kind of comedy in certain types of films, because there's definitely a lot of propaganda in films too. But done right, that is a way to initiate the process where someone hears that line in a song or from a film or whatever, and it gets them going, and then maybe they open some books. Maybe they start reading Mises, maybe, or Ron Paul, or Hayek, or whatever, and they start learning about economics, and they start empowering their own life. Or they read philosophers, you know, they start. That's a big if. Some people will. But more likely is that a small group of people read all the philosophy and make films about it, and people watch those movies, and that's how you get start spreading it.
Yeah, I think cultural products, like art, I think art does really speak to people in a way that nothing else can. And so that is absolutely crucial. But I think sort of like the personal development angle, that everyone is interested in personal development. I mean, everyone has a career, and everyone has, you know, a family life, and so another angle is just raising children, like how you raise your children. So that's like another great example of how the freedom philosophy is a life philosophy.
Imagine if we had all the energy focused on like child raising that we have during these elections and things.
Yeah,
like, the information about, you know, what's healthy for your child psychologically and how to deal with like problems that everybody comes up with. Mm-hmm. I don't think people start bothering to even look at that until right before they're about to become a parent. You know, that's something that is a general knowledge that ought to be discussed way before you even think about getting married, having kids, or you don't even have to be married, but whatever. Like, that should be a school topic. Mm-hmm. And because that is the future. It's, you know, how to raise your children. And I think that is the cornerstone of why certain cultures fail and others don't, is the kind of parenting philosophy. If you have bad parenting, you're done.
Yeah, yeah, and you're not going to believe in freedom in general if you don't believe that freedom was beneficial to you and to your kids. And because I really think that unschooling and peaceful parenting and giving your children both freedom and responsibility, that is the happiest way, that is the best way of raising your kids to be happy people. And it's just, it's the key to just a happy household. And it's really hard to imagine kids being raised in that way and seeing all the benefits that came from learning through freedom, that they would then all of a sudden turn around and say like, oh, well, freedom worked for me as a child growing up, but, you know, freedom doesn't work for, you know, society in general. Like I really, you know, unschooled kids are just going to be natural libertarians. And mm-hmm. So to the extent that we could convince parents that, like, okay, forget about who you're voting for and forget about, you know, where you stand on this particular policy issue, just let's talk about your kids. Let's talk about your household and whether it's happy or not.
Joy, like, through accomplishment. Be happy and give your kids tasks and let them fail and give them a little life management. And we're coming up to the end here, but something you said with like the late Russell Means, Lakota Indian, the freedom to be responsible. And he lost to Ron Paul by just one vote in the Libertarian candidacy back in 1988. But Russell Means was saying, we're talking about a state within a state when you're talking about Indian reservations. I hate that word. But they just want to be left alone and have the freedom to be responsible. That all this help and welfare and stuff has destroyed their society. And this is sort of a microcosm of the macrocosm. You have to have the freedom to be responsible in a happy household. And all this other stuff is, you know, inconsequential. It's, you've got to fix the family. You got to fix the parenting. And get away from the people screaming at you on the news, these talking heads and squawk box yelling about the economy, which is not centrally managed, and they have nothing to do with it. You know? Right. Like, they're watching the stock channel, and like, you don't have any stocks. You're not going to buy anything. You're watching this as infotainment. Like, what do you, and even if you did, what do you got, a few $1,000 or whatever? It's not going to matter. Like, but Dan Sanchez, thank you for coming on the show. Dan Sanchez, the philosopher. I'm going to start the, I like it.
Well, you're quite the philosopher yourself.
I have a degree in philosophy, but I'm not a philosopher. I'm definitely a nerd, and I definitely love superheroes. And I would call myself a geopolitical analyst, but I don't have the arrogance enough to be a philosopher. I just enjoy it. And I think philosophy is something that's under – I did this video called The Philosophy of Happiness. You might like it, might not. But it's something that's under focus. Like, we focus on politics and policies and things, but not enough on philosophy, philosophy of economics, philosophy of happiness, philosophy of parenting. People treat philosophy like it's just some sort of extracurricular activity, and this is something too in the way that subjects are have a sort of pyramid hierarchy in school, like math and English are on the top, and then you have like history and so on, then your electives, and then your art and music and PE and philosophy and stuff like that is on the bottom. These are the not important things. Health is an elective. Whereas health and philosophy, and these are the subjects on the top, and actually mathematics and stuff, while important, most of that is not a daily thing, like that you're going to, English, you already speak it, you know, like these are the things that are extra. Literature is extra. That's something to enjoy, and it's valuable, but it's not as valuable as health. It's not as valuable as understanding economics, philosophy. All the extra courses are on the bottom, and it's everything's reversed in school. So maybe what we really need to get at is writing, and this has probably been done, but books about our educational system and, you know, what's wrong with it, what's right about it. And really the way out of it isn't to change the school system, but basically to get your kids home and then teach them what they really need to know. Socially and academically.
Yeah, make the world their school and not making the school their world.
Wow. They have things like that in Germany now. They have like a kindergarten in the woods and things. The problem is that stuff gets too Fruit Loopy. Where like, oh, there are no right or wrong answers, and they don't. Like what you and I are talking about, I just want to be clear, is not some fluffy cultural relativism or anything at all. Culture definitely matters. We're just talking about getting out of this obedience loop.
Yeah. Yeah, and the world isn't like just the woods. I mean, the world is...
Cities.
Gradually being integrated into the adult world through experience and through learning from people of all ages and learning from actually providing value to people and getting value in return.
We should have that as a libertarian slogan where they say, and someone says, oh, are you a Democrat or Republican? The response should be, oh, no, I'm a grown-up. I choose to be a grown-up instead.
Yeah.
That's really what it is. These people are like little Muppet characters. I could talk about Jim Henson with you too, but we'll save it for another time. So this is Dan Sanchez, and he also writes on antiwar.com. I don't know if I mentioned that in the beginning. If not, then so. And then, on of course, on Fee. And Fee is linked below, and you can find his columns on antiwar there on the right side, I think right below Justin Raimondo. Anything else you'd like to plug?
I think that covers it.
All right. And I'm going to just last question. This is the most serious question. And don't look at my shirt. Doesn't matter. It's random. Marvel or DC?
God.
This is how I'm going to get half the people that hate you.
I would have to say that I really, in terms of the movie franchise, definitely Marvel. In terms of the comic books, I would say DC.
I think as far as live-action movies, Marvel, as far as animated movies, DC.
I would agree with that, too.
TV, yeah. I'm kind of split because I really liked Daredevil, and I'm liking I like all of it, so, yeah. All right, good non-answer answer.
Yeah. That was,
there is some politician in Dan Sanchez. Right. Me too. That's my honest answer. I think I'm a little bit more Marvel, but I flip flop because there are particular characters in DC. I'm like, oh, but Batman is so cool, and Superman, Grant Morrison, Superman.
Yeah, that's what more is the indication is it written by Grant Morrison?
Or the writer. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because when Grant Morrison was at DC, I was all about DC. When he was writing JLA. Especially, and then when he was writing the new X-Men in Marvel, I was all about Marvel, and then he came back to DC and he wrote All-Star Superman, which is just a classic. I have a whole article about Grant Morrison. It's called Grant Morrison versus the Super Soldier, and it's all about how he opposes the militarization of the superhero, So I'm definitely a fellow geek.
It really is the writer. And see, this sort of is like our whole political discussion. We didn't get trapped into party tribalism. We said, well, it's this individual. And that's how it is for comics. And that was the answer I was looking for. All right. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you again in the future. We'll put this up later today or tonight, your time, whatever it is over there.
Okay, awesome.
All right, sayonara.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
I encourage you to please help ANC continue going. I've made a few thousand videos now. I've also written a few books and made some full-length documentary films. We're doing film screenings. We have the podcast. We're really building this alternative media, and I need your help. You can support me on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. Please click the link below and consider becoming a supporter. There's also a lot of perks that come with that. Thank you.